its time.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kip Purcell on behalf of Appellant Quantum Entertainment Limited. This case involves the Department of the Interior Bureau of Indian Affairs invalidation of my client's contract to manage a tribal corporation's gasoline distribution business. The department declared the contract invalid under an 1871 statute, 25 U.S.C. Section 81, which the parties have denominated Old Section 81, and which required the Secretary of the Interior or his designee to approve any contract between a tribe of Indians and a private party, whereby the private party received compensation in consideration of services relative to Indian lands.
Actually, the text of the statute is a little different, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. But I think that is the sense of it.
It says, no person shall enter into any agreement with any tribe unless the Secretary approves.
Yes, Your Honor, and it has been, it does apply, however, only to non-Indian parties when it says no person.
And your client was no person.
That is correct, Your Honor. And so two of the questions in this case are, first of all, whether this contract and this statute, which courts have repeatedly held to be applied to land transactions, has any application to a contract that scarcely even mentions real property. Another issue is whether this contract...
The Supreme Court had applied it to that sale of logs case.
Yes, it has, Your Honor, and our belief is that that is actually a real estate. At bottom, it is a real estate case, but that is, as many other courts have said, an ancient case that has obscure reasoning. And
you're relying on a couple of ancient cases.
Well, we are. Yes, we are required to rely on some ancient cases regarding this ancient statute. And another question, of course, is whether this contract, in which most of the promises, almost all of the promises run between my client and a tribal corporation, is with an Indian tribe. But the threshold, and I think the most interesting question posed by this appeal, is whether the department applied the right version of 25 U.S.C. Section 81. This contractual agreement, or this business relationship, whichever it is properly described as, was entered into between the parties in 1996. In 2000, Congress completely overhauled Section 81, and the statute now says that the Secretary of the Interior must approve any contract that encumbers Indian lands for a period of 7 years or more.
And you rely on the Senate report, which goes into great detail saying how 81 was firmly established and Congress had whittled away at it over the years, but the core was still in place.
It was.
This is Congress talking after the contract was entered here.
Correct, Your Honor. But I think the significance of that, of the legislative history, is that Congress, first of all, believed that the courts that had very expansively interpreted old Section 81 were not getting it right. But second, that there had been...
I didn't find that in the report, candidly.
Well, there are, and it's not as explicit as it might be, but there is certainly an indication that the Congress that enacted new Section 81 took a very dim view of some of the precedents that had been...
There's nothing there that suggests that they wanted it applied retroactively, is there?
There isn't, Your Honor, except in this sense, that Congress was concerned about the jeopardy in which old Section 81 placed all kinds of contracts, and talked about that in the present tense.
That's generally what Congress says when they change a law. They don't like the way the law was progressing before, so they establish a new law. But in Lansgraf, the court said the presumption has to be that if it's not clearly indicated, that it doesn't have retroactive effect.
And we agree that the statute itself does not tell you whether it applies to pre-existing contracts. And so...
Isn't that the end of the matter?
It is not, Your Honor, because retroactive effect is a term of art. Retroactive effect does not mean any statute that applies to pre-existing conduct must be applied only to future conduct. It means that if it is unfair to apply that statute to pre-existing conduct, then the court will not.
Lansgraf doesn't use the word unfair, does it? That's not the test it applies.
No, it does not, Your Honor. But the court says that we don't mean that any statute cannot be applied to pre-existing conduct. And Justice Stevens says judges have a pretty good idea of what's fair and what's not, and that's what our... what our test is.
Well, that's actually not what they... yes, he says that as he gets to the test, but in the end, the last paragraph of Part 4 of the opinion says what the test is. When, however, the statute contains no such express command, the court must determine whether the new statute would have a retroactive effect, i.e., whether it would impair rights a party possessed when he acted, increase a party's liability for past conduct, or impose new duties with respect to transactions already completed. That's the whole test. The words unfair are not in there anywhere.
It is true, Your Honor, that those words don't appear there. But I think that is the substance of the test, because there are clearly situations in which the court is willing to apply new statutes to old conduct. And so the question is this one of those situations? And we believe it is, Your Honor, because... the Supreme Court, in a number of cases from the 1800s and even into this century, has repeatedly held that statutes that merely remove pre-existing statutory impediments to the enforcement of contracts are properly applied to contracts entered into before the statute's enactment.
Isn't that, in Lansgraf, they discussed the fact that the rules were unclear in the past, and in the past there were some cases where the court applied the opposite presumption, that is a presumption of retroactivity, but Lansgraf was establishing a new rule.
Lansgraf was harmonizing the cases, said that Bradley versus School Board, of course, states one poll, and Bowen stated another. Bradley said you apply the rule that's in force when the decision is made, and of course, if that were the rule, we would win in this case. But Lansgraf said it's a more complicated test than that, and you have to determine whether this is a situation that involves new legal consequences, imposes new legal duties. And our belief, Your Honor, is that this series of Supreme Court opinions from, admittedly from an earlier era, but right up until 1937, where I think it's fair to say the trail goes cold, repeatedly hold that contracts are made to be enforced. That is the natural state of affairs.
You're talking about Ewell and McNair, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But
there are a number of cases. We've cited a Georgetown Law Review, Georgetown Law Journal article.
There are other Supreme Court cases?
Yes. This is a series of Supreme Court cases, and there are quite a number of them, actually. They involve statutes that lengthen statutes of limitation for contract enforcement, statutes that validate corporate bonds that may have been entered into ultra vires, A number of cases in the 1800s and 1900s that apply this principle, and pretty consistently, and very difficult to find any cases to the contrary. And our submission is that this is a class of cases that does not in any legally meaningful sense impose new legal duties. Even though it is true that after 2000, a contract of the sort that my client entered into with the Pueblo would be enforceable, whereas previously it was not, that is not, in our view, a new legal consequence that the court will refuse to impose.
Isn't it a new duty that otherwise, without that statute, the tribe wouldn't have to pay? I mean, under your view, they have to pay money, and under the old statute, they don't have to pay money. That seems like a new duty.
Correct, Your Honor. But this series of Supreme Court cases essentially holds that is the natural state of affairs. I don't want to talk about natural law, but that is legal systems exist primarily or largely, let's say, to protect contracts, to enforce agreements that the parties have entered into voluntarily. And to the extent that there are statutory obstacles to the enforcement of contracts and those obstacles are removed by subsequent statutes, the presumption in all of those old Supreme Court cases is those can have backward-looking effect.
Any case involving a situation where one of the parties to the agreement did not have the power to enter into a contract at all?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that was the situation in Ewell, for example, in which...
But those were both adults able to contract.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Those involved adults able to contract. There was no disability on them as individuals in terms of having the power to contract. They just entered into a contract that at that time was illegal.
Yes, Your Honor, and we think that that's exactly
the
situation.
You think the two are the same?
I do, Your Honor, because effectively, tribes under old Section 81 had the ability to continue to perform contracts that are unapproved by the Secretary indefinitely. They also had the power to elect to repudiate those contracts. They had the power to ask the Secretary to validate them retroactively. These are all the...
You say they had the power. If the Secretary didn't do it, what power did they have?
Well, in that case, they had none, but it is true, Your Honor, that the Secretary had the ultimate call, but the administration of the statute, the history of the administration shows that the Secretary usually deferred to the Indian tribes' desires about whether
not
to...
Not always.
Not always, Your Honor, but in recent times, repeatedly.
So... We should disregard the intent of the 41st Congress.
I don't think we should disregard it, Your Honor, but it does need to be read, I think, in light of the intentions of the Congress that enacted a new Section 81.
The Supreme Court has repeatedly said a new Congress cannot change the intent of an old Congress, much less define it.
It has, Your Honor, in a number of cases. I would say that Indian law cases state a somewhat different rule, and I'm talking about Central Machinery and Bryan versus Itasca County, that we read old Indian statutes with full force, with the intent of the enacting Congress until Congress repeals them.
But there's nothing here that says, and you don't suggest this, that Congress, or as the board put it, that this was a relief act for those persons who had entered into an agreement without the Secretary's approval of what the tribe had agreed to.
There's nothing on the face of the statute that says that it should be applied.
Indeed, the whole thrust of the Senate report is that 81 exists, the courts have been applying it, and we think it's time for a change.
That is the thrust of the report. There is this suggestion that that Congress was concerned about existing contracts. That same suggestion, same kind of suggestion, was present in the McNair versus Knott case.
But all I'm getting at, they didn't say that the protection that we have afforded to Indian tribes, this should be disregarded as to pre-existing contracts.
No, but they said that this protection has been unnecessary for years and years and conflicts.
Well, you say they said that. I didn't find that. There's a lot in there about how our attitude about Indians has changed. And this may be, this paternalism may be anachronistic. But I just don't see them saying, and we intend to, as it were, make all these contracts enforceable.
They did not say anything like that, Your Honor. We agree with that. But we do believe that it's significant that Congress took a very dim view of the existing precedents under old Section 81 and said this is inconsistent with principles of tribal autonomy that have been enacted in our law since 1934.
Even in 2000, they didn't give full autonomy to the tribe. So they're still sticking with their notion of paternalism to some extent, even
yes.
to this day.
Yes, the Congress noted that the Department of the Interior said that the statute should be abolished altogether. They didn't go quite that far.
What are the consequences for your argument of the D.C. Circuit decision that the government gave us yesterday, on which says that we owe deference to the agency, even on this question of retroactivity?
Your Honor, I hope that the panel has received our response to that, but it is...
I've not. Have you?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, I don't
know
anything.
It was attached at the back.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And I apologize for the 12th hour nature of that briefing, but essentially, Your Honor, two responses. First of all, the government did not make that argument in its answer brief, did not respond to the argument that deference is not due under Chevron in questions of statutory retroactivity, so it has waived it to that extent. Also, in the district court, the government explicitly took the position that deference is not due under Chevron on questions of statutory retroactivity. So that's one response, Your Honor. The second response.
Give me another one.
The second response is that this Landgraf created a sea change in the way we look at this question. And after Landgraf, there was a case called INS versus St. Cyr, and there's a footnote in that case in which the INS said,
which is completely inconsistent with the D.C. Circuit's previous opinion, right?
I believe it is.
That's the answer.
Yes.
Yeah. It's been overturned by a Supreme Court opinion.
I think so.
Can I ask you another? I'm sorry, Judge Taylor, you finished?
No, I'm done. Yeah.
I have one more Chevron question for you, which is, assuming we get over the retroactive thing in a way that you don't like, why should we not defer to the government's position with respect to the scope of what relative to Indian lands means?
And that's assuming that I lose on the question of which.
Yes,
statute
that's
applies.
Why I say, assuming yes. that is resolved in a way you don't like and the old section applies.
Well, on the question of deference, first of all, first of all, there is a question of whether Chevron applies to that issue as well. We believe that the governing canon of construction is that Indian statutes are construed in favor of the Indians, which does not mean that necessarily in favor of the particular tribe before
doesn't
the court.
Doesn't mean that, but in terms of this particular statute, the old section, it's clear from the legislative history that parties provided that the purpose of this requirement, the specific requirement of approval, was to protect the Indians. So that would suggest that that is consistent with deferring to the government's view of a broad protection here.
Your Honor,
so the Chevron and the Indian canon apply in the, go and look in the same direction in this case.
I believe, Your Honor, with respect that states the subject matter and the purpose of old Section 81 too broadly. There was also concern among the enacting Congress people that a protection could sweep too broadly. We don't want to prohibit or impede Indians from entering into routine contracts that don't involve situations in which someone is trying to swindle them out of their patrimony. And we don't want to stop commerce on reservations. We want to focus this statute on the situations that had given rise to abuse up until 1871. And those were relative to lands and also annuities and claims against the government. And so it comes back down to what does relative to their lands mean. We believe, Your Honor, that even if Chevron deference is appropriate here on that issue, we believe that the department's view of this is unreasonable because this is a contract.
Unreasonable? That's a pretty strong word for that, isn't it?
It is.
That's obviously not the one that you think is more likely than not, but is it unreasonable?
Well, Your Honor, I believe so. I mean, under Chevron, I think that's what I would have to show.
That's definitely what you have to show. The question is whether you've showed it in light of the way in which the Supreme Court's opinions have described this old section, the logging case that Judge Rogers referred to. I appreciate you could attempt to narrow it in the way that you have because logs have something to do with trees, which has something to do with land, but the court didn't describe it that way.
No, Your Honor. I should also mention, though, that Green versus Menominee Tribe, the Turnkey Gaming case points out, it is possible to view that case as if the discussion of old Section 81 was almost an afterthought or dicta. What really drove the decision in that case was the fact that the Indian tribe had paid the intermediary that was...
I understand that, but if the Supreme Court, even in dicta, described it in the same way that the government is now describing it, it would be hard for us to say, without some embarrassment with respect to how we describe the Supreme Court, to call it unreasonable. Isn't that right?
Well, I think it is possible to view the Green versus Menominee contract as focused on lands. I really don't believe that this case has that feature. This contract does not refer to lands in any way. Of course, it is possible to say that the land has some impact on the value of the contract and therefore on how much the private party can reap under the contract. But that is true of any number of contracts that it would not be reasonable to say fall within the scope of this old statute.
Further questions? We'll hear from the government. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Matt Littleton, representing the Department of the Interior. I'd like to start with the retroactivity point, which took up most of the discussion during the appellate's argument.
Can you start that point with the standard of review, that is, whether Chevron applies or not?
So, and I apologize for the 11th hour of our submission, as appellant mentioned. The case that we cited, Wagner Seed, was a D.C. Circuit case from 1991, which held that Chevron deference applies to an agency's interpretation of whether a statute is retroactive. As the appellant pointed out in his response in a footnote in INS versus St. Cyr, the Supreme Court determined that because of the very strong presumption against retroactivity articulated in Landgraf, it was not appropriate to defer to an agency's interpretation that a statute did apply retroactively.
So the citation you gave us has been overtaken, is that right?
Assuming that the Landgraf presumption applies, as we suggest. That's right.
Well,
what the appellant is arguing, though, is that the Landgraf presumption does not apply here. And if this court were to determine that the Landgraf presumption did not apply, then the reasoning in St. Cyr would not be
Even if the Landgraf presumption applies, which I assume it does, there's still a question of deference, isn't there? Do you agree then with the Chief Judge that at that point there isn't any?
If the... Right.
In other words, if the presumption applies, is that what you're saying? If we agree with you that the presumption applies, the Landgraf presumption applies, then you agree there is no deference, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
So I don't think the court needs to reach the question of deference given that the Landgraf presumption applies here. And I'd like to point out a couple of passages that explain why the Landgraf presumption applies and why the two Supreme Court cases that...
Could you just explain to me, what do you mean by... I understand your argument that there's a presumption against retroactivity, right?
That's correct.
But Landgraf itself says that presumption can be overcome, correct?
That presumption can be overcome by clearing congressional intent. That's correct.
But it can be overcome even if the statute doesn't expressly say anything about it, correct?
It can be overcome, right, if there's no express intent in the text of the statute, if there is strong congressional intent that retroactive application was correct. There are situations in which the presumption does not apply because there is no retroactivity in the broader sense.
Let's just operate on the assumption that the presumption applies. Then go ahead and let me hear your argument.
Okay, so assuming the presumption applies here, the relevant retroactive event is the 1996 signing of the management agreement by the tribe and Quantum. And if, as the appellant contends, new Section 81 applies to the management agreement, it would imbue that agreement, which prior to 2000 had no legal effect for either party, with legal effect and consequences for both parties. So that is the type of impermissible retroactive effect that Landgraf disallows.
So the new legal consequence, as you see it, is that a contract that, under your view, had no legal force, which I want to come back to in a minute, now does, correct? In other words, it's outcome determinative, right?
That's correct.
And, well, then I don't understand what, under, in your view, then, what's left to be done under Landgraf? What does language like this mean? Retroactivity is something on which judges have sound instinct, familiar considerations of fair notice, reasonableness, and settled expectations are important. And then it says, the conclusion that a particular rule operates retroactively comes at the end of a process of judgment concerning the nature and extent of the change in the law. And I don't understand where any of that has any role under your view of retroactivity in this case. As I understand it, you're saying that because new 81 is outcome determinative, that is, because it would determine the results of the case, that it's retroactive, right? That applying it retroactively would be impermissible.
We say that, although we say that after first saying that Congress did not intend that.
What about all the language in Landgraf that suggests that there's an enormous amount of judgment, consideration of lots of different factors? They may not be dispositive, but factors of reasonable reliance, settled expectations, fair notice, they're all, as the courts say, offer sound guidance. Where does that play a role in your thinking about this?
Your Honor, I would go back to Chief Judge Garland's point during the appellant's argument that at the end of the day, at the end of Landgraf's test...
So your view, this language just plays no role in the decision, right? Even in thinking about the last sentence, these factors don't play any role in it? In other words, it's really simple. If Congress has said it's not retroactive, or if it's outcome determinative, right? It's impermissible to apply it retroactive. And I guess I don't see where the law's gone quite that far, given Landgraf and given McNair and Ewell, which are still good law.
Well, I'd like to turn to McNair and Ewell for a minute. And McNair, as we point out in our brief, was a case in which congressional intent was determined to be clear.
Well, but only not in the statute. The statute was no more expressed than the statute here.
But the legislative history.
Okay, so we're back to the question of what the statute meant, right?
Right, and there's okay. and there's no evidence that Congress, in enacting new Section 81, had an intent to apply it to pre-existing agreements. And so, you know, Congress certainly could have added a provision in new Section 81 saying that all agreements not approved to this point by Interior shall henceforth be valid, but it didn't do so. I'd also like to turn to Ewell for a minute, and I'd like to point the court to a passage at page 150 of Ewell, which states that the reasoning in Ewell is partly based in the fact that the statute was in its nature a penal statute, inflicting upon the lender a loss and forfeiture to that extent. It was a usury statute. And in a passage of Landgraf, this is at page 271, the court points out that that common law rule is no longer applicable. So even we submit that this case does not fall within the category of cases that Ewell discusses, but even if it did, Ewell is not good law in the wake of Landgraf on this point.
Part of your argument is that this unapproved contract was null and void, right?
That's correct.
And the blue brief spends quite a few pages arguing that that's not so. It points out that there are lots of board decisions and federal court decisions which hold that a secretary can approve one of these retroactively, which seems inconsistent with the idea that it's null and void, and also that non-Indian parties are bound by them. And I didn't see, you didn't respond to any of that in your brief. And it seems, at least on the surface, that that's inconsistent with the notion that this is a null and void contract.
But Your Honor, I think there's, it is, the statute in Ewell was voidable in the sense that.
I was asking you to respond to the arguments in the blue brief that these were, in fact, contracts, that they had some force.
Prior to the Secretary's approval, the contract, the management agreement had no force, and neither party could enforce it against the other.
Well, the blue brief says, first of all, that the non-Indian party, namely Quantum, could not have invoked the absence of approval as a defense. Is that not true?
If the tribe had sought to affirmatively enforce the contract in court, Quantum could have asserted it as a defense.
Could have?
Yes.
So you're telling me that what's in the blue brief is just flat out wrong?
In that respect, I would say that if Quantum was sued for breach of contract.
Why didn't you tell us that? Why didn't you cite some cases for the contrary proposition or distinguish the cases that they cite?
Your Honor, I apologize. I think that there are a few cases in this area where there's a contract that has not been presented to Interior for several years and the parties have performed.
And what about their argument that you agree with them that it can be approved by the Secretary retroactively?
It can be approved retroactively, yes. So the Supreme Court has decided that in Likens.
Then how can, isn't that a little inconsistent with the idea that it's null and void? That means the period of time prior to approval could be enforceable, correct? Doesn't sound to me like a null and void contract.
Well, I would say that it falls somewhere in between the voidable contract in Ewell and a complete null and void contract
That's not what you said in your brief. Okay. Okay, well, go ahead. Did you want to?
I just thought your argument was a little different. It wasn't that it was void or voidable, but it was absolutely void.
Well,
there was no contract.
There was no contract, and neither party could enforce it unless and until it was approved by the Department of Interior. That's right. I see I'm out of time. If the court wishes, I can turn to the other.
I just understand your last response to Judge Tatel, though. You said this 1996 contract is somewhere in between Ewell and what?
Well, a complete null and void contract that could never be brought into existence even by a non-party, in this case the Secretary of Interior, would be absolutely void in the sense that the courts have used absolutely void. It, however, a voidable contract in the sense that you will use that term is a contract that could be enforced against one party by the party who, so for example,
I understand that, yeah.
Okay.
I just didn't know what it was in between. I mean, I thought your argument was there was no contract whatsoever.
There was no contract, and neither party could unilaterally enforce the contract. Right. It's a bit of a unique situation because an entity not party to the contract could bring the contract into existence. That's not a situation addressed by Ewell.
So I have a question. I think this issue may be waived by the failure of either party to discuss it, but nonetheless, it concerns me a little bit. In that paragraph of Landgraf that you were referring to.
That's correct.
The one that talks about the common law statutes having, common law having a different rule. There is at the very end of the paragraph, but see 1 USC section 109, repealing common law rule. And that statute, that federal statute says, the repeal of any statute shall not have the effect to release or extinguish any penalty, forfeiture, or liability incurred under such statute unless the repealing act shall so expressly provide. What's the consequence of that for this case?
The consequence of that, Your Honor, is that essentially Landgraf applies in that situation because that is effectively the Landgraf rule, that unless Congress expressly provides.
What's the consequence for this case? So it says the repeal of any statute shall not have the effect to release or extinguish any liability incurred under such statute. What does that have to do? How would we apply that to the old section?
If this court determines that Ewell is still good law.
Leave it.
Okay.
Maybe I better suggest what your argument should be, and then you can tell me whether that is your argument, and then I'll ask the other side. So under the old statute, the plaintiffs here now have a liability to the tribe, correct?
Correct.
Tribe can sue them to get the money back.
Right.
That they paid them, right?
Or vice versa, potentially.
Well, under the old statute, if it was null and void, isn't it correct that agreement that's in violation of that, which they've been paying under, they could sue to get their money back?
That's right.
And in fact, I think disgorgement was ordered in this case, correct?
Yes, although
subject to quantum merit.
Right, although the board determined that disgorgement was not something that BIA could do in and of itself through an administrative process.
So my question is, does this congressional statute then decide this case? The repeal of any statute shall not have the effect to release any liability incurred under such statute. And the argument, I guess, which I'd like you to address and opposing counsel to address is that the old statute created liability on the part of the plaintiffs here, and repealing it by adopting the new statute wasn't supposed to release that liability.
If Ewell applies, then yes, that statute would control here. However, we contend that Ewell doesn't even apply in the first place. So Ewell, in other words.
I think you're misunderstanding my argument. I think that this overrules. My question is, doesn't this statute overrule Ewell and everything else? This statute, section 109, doesn't it say that if there were liability under old section, whatever the number is, that the passage of the new section doesn't change that liability, and therefore the plaintiffs here, petitioners here, still owe that liability to the Indian tribe?
Yes.
So why didn't you tell us that, I guess, and why doesn't the other side distinguish that? Why isn't, is there something I'm missing here? This seems like an incredibly important statute. Nobody cites it. Usually when that happens, it means that I'm wrong, that I'm reading something into something that really doesn't apply at all. Does this statute apply, Section 109, or not?
We don't think that even under the old rule of Ewell, we don't think that the management agreement is the type of agreement to which Ewell would apply. And so there was no need to, we don't need to get to the question whether Ewell was repealed. However, if this court agrees that Ewell would be applicable and apply a presumption of retroactivity, to this type of contract or this management agreement, then Yule has been overruled to that extent.
You know, have you read 109 before today?
Yes.
So then why didn't you, why not, I'm going to ask this the other side too, it's not only your fault, but why isn't this statute, unless you were unbelievably confident that you were going to win your Yule argument, why isn't this statute discussed?
The statute was something that, in preparation for argument, I became aware of. However, given that we had already cited Landgraf's presumption of retroactivity and the fact that the Yule presumption did not apply, it did not seem appropriate for supplemental authority in that situation. However, I apologize. I should have informed the court.
I don't know whether you need to apologize or not, because I don't know whether it applies or not. Okay, any further questions? All right, no. We'll hear from the other side.
I echo those apologies. I have not examined that statute, and I would appreciate an opportunity to submit a supplemental brief about it. I do agree that on the face of the statute, had the tribe pressed at any time for a refund of those monies, if that statute applies, then that might entitle them to those monies. I'd have to say that that argument has not been made in this case, and the only question is, does the contract still exist? Now, if the tribe is entitled to its money back, then that's a good indication that the contract doesn't exist. But since this has never been raised by the government in this case, would appreciate an opportunity to brief it supplementally.
Why don't you both... give us letters on this question by the middle of next week, by the end of day Wednesday, without prejudice to our possibly deciding this is all waived by the failure of the parties to raise it in the briefs.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd appreciate that opportunity. I did want to address briefly the presumption, the standard of review. The government has suggested that If the presumption applies of retroactivity under Landgraf, then Chevron deference is not owed, but not otherwise. I would refer the court to Martinez versus INS, which is cited in our briefs, 523 F3rd 365, in which the Second Circuit said, Chevron deference isn't owed to the agency's determination that this would have an impermissible retroactive effect either. We don't give Chevron deference in any of those statutory retroactivity situations.
And it's citing other Second Circuit cases, and did it cite St. Cyr?
It cited St. Cyr, yes.
That's footnote 45.
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I see that my time is up. I would be happy.
Any further questions? Ben?
No.
All right, we'll take the matter under submission. Thank you very much.
Thank you.